He doesn't talk like that, by the way. That was like Western Michigan accent.
Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore, director of the new film Michael Moore in Trumpland. And that does it for our show. To see part one of our discussion with Michael, go to democracynow.org. Also, we're doing a five-hour election night special. That's Tuesday night, 7 to midnight Eastern time. Check it out at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkner, Meet Shay, Carla Wells, Laura Gottes, Dina Dietgeister. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hey Boo Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice a board meeting in writing, please email monica@kboo.org.
Tune in Tuesday, November 8th for KBOO Community Radio's live election night coverage. We'll be broadcasting from 5 to 9 p.m. with news headlines, election returns, analysis, comedy, and the Mood Ring Report. We'll have the KBOO News House Band live featuring the saxophone percussion genius Shoehorn and the best musicians in town. We'll also be checking in with our alternative radio news partners in the Oregon Media Association around the state of Oregon. This year, we're crashing the Willamette Week's party at Grand Central Bowl. Check that out. Always independent, always fingers on the pulse. Our news crew will be watchdogging the FBI itself, as well as the political parties. So don't miss it. That's Tuesday, November 8th, from 5 to 9 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, FBI Director James Comey told Congress on Sunday that there's no evidence Hillary Clinton broke the law in regard to emails on her private server.
We'll have an update on the ongoing protests at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline.
And after this newscast, we'll have a special extended in-depth report on voting in the U.S. with KBOO's own Don Merrill, interviewing state secretaries of state from around the country.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 7th, 2016. I am Tony LaTigra.
And I'm Ken Jones. Activists at Standing Rock yesterday held several demonstrations in the name of protecting water and sacred burial sites, meeting resistance from local police and deputy sheriffs. UnicornRiot.Ninja posted live streaming video from a burial site demonstration in Bismarck where activists raised awareness and planted red shovels, asking local residents, "How would you like it if we dug up your ancestors?" Another video from Sunday shows water protectors canoeing across a tributary of the Cannonball River to set up a new camp. They were met with police and tear gas on the other side. A forgiveness walk ceremony was carried out by a third group at the Morton County Law Enforcement Center in Mandan with the stated goal of dispelling, quote, burdens of bitterness and anger resulting from traumatic experiences with police. Rumors arose that talks between tribal representatives and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had led to a 30-day halt of construction on the pipeline, but a Mother Jones reporter learned that this was, quote, only a proposal. The Red Warrior Camp page on Facebook has called for activists everywhere to join them on the front lines in defending the land from corporate invasion and list ways to plug into the Solidarity Network.
Two documentary filmmakers who faced decades in prison for filming part of the shutdown of all tar sands pipelines into the U.S. have had all charges against them dropped. The Skagit County, Washington prosecutor's office dropped the charges against filmmaker Lindsay Grazel and cinematographer Carl Davis. The two were arrested October 1st for filming climate activist Ken Ward as he shut down a Trans Mountain oil pipeline in Burlington, Washington. Grazel, Davis, and Ward, who is the subject of Grazel's documentary short The Reluctant Radical, were among 10 activists across four states who were charged after taking part in the Shut It Down Day of Action. The filmmakers faced charges of burglary, criminal sabotage, assemblage of saboteurs, and criminal trespass, with a maximum punishment of 30 years and a fine of $46,000.
Six protesters were arrested over the weekend in the Portland observance of the Million Mask March, which wound through downtown on Saturday night. Also known as Guy Fawkes Day, the annual anti-capitalist observance is convened every November 5th by Anonymous, the global movement against capitalism. Dozens of marchers wearing Guy Fawkes masks face cold, rainy weather in disrupting Portland traffic, eventually shutting down Interstate 5.
Portland Community College's Rock Creek campus was closed today after the college received a bomb threat. Students and faculty were evacuated after the bomb threat against the college was phoned in. The Washington County Sheriff's Department conducted a building-by-building search, but no explosives were discovered. Classes at the Rock Creek campus are set to resume on Tuesday.
Oregon's Measure 97 has become the costliest campaign in the state's history. $42.5 million has already been spent on the measure, with more than 60% spent by the no side. Measure 97 would tax corporations 2.5% on all sales over $25 million in any given year. It's been estimated that the tax would generate $3 billion per year for the state, though it would only affect a few very large corporations. Top donors for No on 97 include Albertsons, Costco, and Fred Meyer, all of which donated more than $2 million each to defeat the corporate tax initiative. Top donors on the yes side include the Service Employees International Union, donating more than $5 million, and the Oregon Education Association, donating almost $4.5 million. The previous record amount spent on an Oregon campaign was the 2014 GMO labeling law, Measure 92. That measure was defeated by 800 votes, less than 0.01%. Almost $30 million was spent on that campaign, more than 70% of which was spent by the no sign, mainly by the multinational GMO producers Monsanto and DuPont.
The Rose City Rollers won the 2016 International Women's Flat Track Derby Association Championship Sunday night for the second consecutive year. That's right. The coveted Hydra Trophy stays in Puddletown for another year instead of moving to New York City. The Rollers defeated New York City's Gotham Roller Girls by a score of 185 points to 166. The three-day event took place at Portland's Memorial Coliseum with a total of 16 teams from the U.S., Canada, Australia, and Europe. The Rose City Rollers League was founded in 2004 and is made up of a dozen individual programs and teams totaling 400 members, making it one of the largest roller derby leagues in the world. Their increasing membership implies a growing popularity, and with it, a greater economic impact. The Oregon Sports Authority estimated that local businesses would benefit from this year's competition to the tune of $1.4 million. The Rose City Rollers fan base includes partnerships with Skate Like a Girl PDX, the Portland Firefighters Association, Big Brothers Big Sisters, and the Outside In Trans Clinic, which provides mental health resources for the youth and adult members of the LGBT community on a sliding scale.
A federal jury has awarded $37 million to the victim of a police beating that was caught on video in Flint, Michigan. William Jennings sued Genesee County Sheriff's officers for use of excessive force following his arrest for drunk driving in 2010. Surveillance camera footage showed a group of police appearing to assault Jennings while he was handcuffed and seemingly immobilized inside the jail. The footage was obtained via a Freedom of Information Act request by the Flint Journal. Lawyers for the defense say Jennings was drunk and belligerent during booking, and they plan to appeal the verdict. Dean Elliott, one of the attorneys representing Jennings, said he was pleased by the verdict, though surprised at the huge amount of the settlement. Elliott said, quote, "I think that the jurors were sending a message to the sheriff that these kinds of actions cannot go on."
After setting the world on edge by vaguely accusing Hillary Clinton of wrongdoing this past week, FBI Director James B. Comey told Congress Sunday there is no evidence Clinton broke the law. Again. Comey had already investigated leaked emails from the Clinton campaign and announced there was no wrongdoing last July. The FBI also last week investigated itself for a series of tweets that emerged from an obscure account and appeared to say positive things about Donald Trump. The agency says it was an accidental discharge of old Freedom of Information Act requests. It just so happened that none of them favored the Clinton campaign. Also last week, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani admitted publicly he knew the FBI was planning to review more Clinton emails prior to the public announcement by FBI Director James Comey. That admission prompted accusations the FBI is leaking information to the Trump campaign.
Despite a spike in calls for more election observers, the U.S. Justice Department will be sending out fewer observers to monitor intimidation at the polls. That's because the Supreme Court in 2013 gutted provisions of the Voting Rights Act, ruling they were no longer necessary. This year, the DOJ says 500 trained observers will be dispatched to polling places compared to 780 who monitored polling places during the last general election in 2012. Trained observers have special standing to view all aspects of the electoral process and cannot be ejected from the scene. Despite the 35% reduction in monitors, federal officials say they'll be watching 67 jurisdictions in 28 states on Election Day.
The U.S. hit a new record for total acreage cultivated with organic crops in 2016. This year, 15,000 organic farms planted more than 4 million acres of organic crops, an 11% increase over last year alone. The top five states for acreage planted with organics were California, Montana, Wisconsin, New York, and North Dakota. Oregon was number five on the list in 2015, but was passed by North Dakota this year and dropped to number six. Wheat, hay, corn, and soybeans were the largest organic crops grown in the country last year. Despite the increase, organic wheat remained below 1% of total wheat cultivated. Organic corn and soybean crops made up less than 1/3 of 1% of total corn and soybean crops nationwide.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special extended report on voting in the U.S. with KBOO's own Don Merrill interviewing secretaries of state from around the country. At 6, it's Labor Radio of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, presenting a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and challenging the status quo. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, views and news from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, with a low around 49, east wind around 6 miles per hour. Tomorrow, Election Day, sunny with a high near 70. East wind around 5 miles per hour, becoming south, southeast in the afternoon. Today in history, in 1893, Colorado voters approved an initiative, making it the first state to grant women the right to vote. In 1916, Jeanette Rankin of Montana was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, becoming the first woman in Congress. The quote of the day is from a former Oregon governor, the late Tom McCall, who said, "Heroes are not giant statues framed against a red sky. They're people who say, this is my community, and it's my responsibility to make it better."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. For Association of Flight Attendants CWA President Sarah Nelson, this election represents an opportunity to choose progress, inclusivity, and unity over hate and divisiveness. She says while it's sad and scary to see discrimination and sexism being embraced by a significant portion of the mainstream American electorate, her union will continue fighting for equality and stay true to core principles, regardless of who wins the White House.
Also, equality for the millions of people who come on and off our airplanes and all the communities where we live and work and visit around the world. And these are the basic principles of the United States. And so we hope that this election will send a very clear message that we continue as a nation, continue to hold these principles dear to our heart, and we will be working very closely with, we hope, President Clinton to promote that and to push forward on equality for all. I tend to believe that love does trump hate, and that we will overcome that.
Nelson says in the new year, flight attendants will be wary of efforts to use flags of convenience in the airline industry to promote erosion of labor rights and compensation for U.S.-based flight attendants. She says AFA-CWA will also fight the so-called open skies concept airlines are pushing.
That would drive to the very lowest labor standards in the world and force us to compete with that and ultimately put us out of work. And so we will be very much in a defensive mode on any trade agreements that limit our right to organize, our right to collectively bargain, our right to good U.S. jobs.
TWU 234 President Willie Brown is blasting SEPTA for going to court to try for an injunction to force striking workers back to work. The Pennsylvania transit strike is coming up on a full week. Brown said, "We can't get anywhere at the bargaining table because SEPTA has pinned their hopes on getting an injunction to end the strike. SEPTA Board Chairman Pat Dionne's plan all along has been to rely on the courts rather than negotiations," end quote. Brown says this is not the way to end a strike or get a labor agreement. SEPTA's bid to have a judge order an end to the strike failed Friday, but hearings on the strike continue on Monday.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
Brought to you by UnionJobs.com, posting jobs for unions, socially allied, and community organizations since 1997.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
On Sunday, another large earthquake hit Oklahoma, making it the most earthquake-prone state in the nation. The epicenter of the quake was in Cushing, Oklahoma, a town known as the pipeline crossroads of the nation. The earthquake was felt in a radius of more than 300 miles and damaged several buildings in the area. It was the 19th earthquake to hit Oklahoma in the last week alone. Over the last several years, Oklahoma has been hit with more earthquakes annually than the state had experienced for the previous 30 years combined. Authorities believe the quakes are being generated by the injection of fracking waste into the bedrock. The U.S. Geological Society projects that in 2016, up to 15% of all houses in the area could face damage from earthquakes.
Police pepper-sprayed demonstrators in Hong Kong over the weekend as protests erupted over plans to prevent two newly elected members of the Hong Kong Legislative Council from taking their seats. Sixtus Leong and Yao Wei-Ching are pro-independence politicians who were elected to the Hong Kong Assembly in September. Last month, during their swearing-in ceremony, the two pledged allegiance to the Hong Kong nation rather than China, and displayed a banner reading, "Hong Kong is not China," which angered authorities. About 10,000 protesters marched on Chinese government offices in Hong Kong in support of the two. In spite of the demonstrations, China's parliament earlier today passed a rule effectively blocking them from taking office.
A UN agency reported last week that Israel's seizure and destruction of items provided by international donors as humanitarian assistance to the Palestinian people has increased 150% since the beginning of the year. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in the Occupied Palestinian Territories said that in the last half of October, Israeli authorities demolished or confiscated 18 structures in six Palestinian communities of East Jerusalem in Area C, displacing 54 people, including 29 children, and affecting the livelihoods of more than 46 others. It also said that eight of the targeted structures, including residential shelters, latrines, and a water cistern, had been provided as humanitarian assistance in response to previous demolitions.
And in the Palestinian West Bank, a circus school just marked its 10th anniversary with a big festival. It invited circus troops from around the world to participate. But in Palestine, even doing circus presents a challenge. Lena Otgard reports.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the opening gala of the Palestinian Circus Festival.
In a public park in Ramallah in the West Bank, thousands of Palestinians of all ages gasped, laughed, and clapped as artists from countries including Germany, Denmark, Argentina, and Mexico performed acrobatic stunts. It was the gala opening of Palestine's first international circus festival, and for many, the first time to see circus acts. The festival was hosted by the Palestinian Circus School and marked its 10th anniversary. When the school first opened, there were few indications that circus would become this popular. At the circus school near Ramallah, students were busy making decorations for the festival out of empty soda cans. Shadis Morod is one of the school's founders.
I remember the first class we had, we were three trainers and three students.
Today, more than 300 students attend classes here, and the school is continuously expanding. But circus is still widely unfamiliar to many Palestinians.
Well, people think, okay, circus is an animal, is a clown, make us laugh. We try to do shows that makes, that has a message about education, about recycling.
Not everyone believes such messages are important in an area affected by almost 50 years of Israeli occupation.
We had one of the public in one of our shows said, oh, you're turning the concentration of our own public from resistance to circus. And he left with his daughter of 3 years old.
Shmorot told the man that he believes circus is a way to resist. Later during the show, he suddenly noticed that the man had returned.
We chose circus and art, physical expression, to resist against occupation, to give a higher self-esteem level for our kids so they can be our future ambassadors abroad.
17-year-old Mohammed Asseh has been a student at this school since its opening.
I grew up here. I was raised by the circus.
2 years ago, Mohammed was shot and critically injured by an Israeli sniper at a protest of the Israeli occupation. Two other young men were killed. Footage published by CNN showed that none of the boys posed a threat when they were shot. The incident didn't stop Mohammed from doing circus, but it did make him reflect.
Everyone has his way to resist, to fight. I see from an experience, I see the circus is more effective than protesting with a stone or with a gun.
In addition to classes and stunts on the trapeze and trampoline, the circus school tours the West Bank and Europe with shows that tackle the occupation as well as conservative social values. For Shmorod, circus is a way to foster change in society.
I don't like public to come to laugh, to join, to clap and leave. No, I need to challenge them.
But the challenge isn't always welcomed by local audiences. One show, which referred to menstruation and sexual harassment in the street, seemingly crossed a line.
Well, the show started, and after 10, 15 minutes, they all left. We talked about real things in life, but when you talk about it on stage, they refuse it.
According to Shmorot, such incidents are rare. He's proud of the fact that an equal number of girls and boys attend circus classes. 16-year-old Darin Awad started at the circus school 3 years ago.
Women in our community don't have a big role. So I think circus is a huge thing for changing our society. Like for the first time, girls can perform a show in Palestine.
Like many aspects of life in the occupied Palestinian territories, running the circus school has its challenges. Trainer and clown Mohammed Abu Sakhar has been detained by the Israeli military for more than 6 months without official charges. The challenges increase when trying to put together an international festival. The anniversary program underwent last-minute changes when Israel refused to issue visas and permits to circus groups from Kenya, Morocco, and Gaza. Other artists spent hours in security interrogations upon arrival. The group Los Cabaret Capricho from Mexico were among the artists who made it. Group member Siso Omar Barrios is aware that doing circus in Palestine is not just about entertainment.
If there is a function for art, one of them is to be political. Circus and clowning inspire. The young generations need to get inspiration for making a better way of life for everyone, you know?
Under the slogan United for Freedom, the festival seeks to shed light on restrictions in freedom of expression and movement due to the Israeli occupation. The Palestinian Circus School hopes to make the international festival a biannual event. Lina Otgor for FSRN in Ramallah in the West Bank.
Over the last week, almost 400 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea, bringing this year's total to more than 4,200 deaths. Many of the refugees are from Libya and Syria, fleeing civil war, violence, and terrorism. The fleeing refugees attempt to cross the Mediterranean Sea for safety in Europe, often on severely overloaded small inflatable rubber rafts and rickety wooden boats. Last year, almost 3,800 refugees died trying to cross the Mediterranean for Greece and Italy. Once in Greece and Italy, the refugees flow toward Germany and the other large industrialized countries of Europe. There's believed to be a 1.5% death rate for refugees attempting the Mediterranean Sea crossing, a voyage of at least 300 miles across often stormy, choppy seas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama, Tony Latigra, Don Zur, and Jeff Anderson. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and Labor Radio. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tony.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Talk Show. At 9, on alternative radio, Alfred McCoy, professor at the University of Wisconsin, discusses the decline of U.S. global power. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host D-May Roberts presents two stories of Chinese-American veterans from different American wars. And at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Joseph Galavan interviews painter Marlena Stoddard-Hayes about her new show, High Fae. Thanks, KBOO members, for your ongoing support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm, that's kboo.fm, and clicking on Donate. Tony, good night. Good night, Danielle.
Thanks, Danielle. Thank you, Ken. And good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community. I'm Don Merrill. I'm talking with C. Norman Turrell, president of League of Women Voters Oregon. Mr. Turrell, welcome.
Hi.
I got an idea a couple of days ago for a quick turnaround project that involved contacting the secretaries of state of each of the 50 states and the U.S. territories. I wanted to ask them to defend and describe the voting processes in their state. I wasn't surprised that each spokesperson described and defended those processes vigorously, but considering the rhetoric around the questions over the voting process, should I have been surprised?
No. Each state is quite different in the way it goes about administering its elections, and there's actually something like 9,000 election administration entities around the state, around the country, and so just the diversity of different election systems provides quite a bit of security for the whole election process throughout the country.
I had a chance to collect some audio segments from some of the other secretaries of state around the country. Here's one from a representative for the Secretary of State of Colorado.
This is Lynn Bartles, and I'm the communications director with the Colorado Secretary of State. Presidential candidate Donald Trump has noted several times on Twitter that he believes the elections are rigged. Well, you can say anything you want on Twitter. I can say I'm a supermodel, but I just bought a size 3X blouse. I mean, you have individual cases of voter fraud, but you don't have wholesale rigging of elections. It would be impossible. You have different voting systems. You have different county clerks of different political persuasions. It's just not the case.
In about half of the states that responded, the Secretary of State, unlike here in Oregon, is not directly responsible for voting and elections. And in those states, they have a board of elections that manages the elections process. What is the distinction between having a Secretary of State manage an election versus having a board of elections manage it?
Well, effectively, it's not, there's not much difference. It's always a somewhat political process, but having a separate board administer the elections hopefully insulates it somewhat from the political processes. In Oregon, the Secretary of State is actually a partisan office, but there hasn't been any suggestion that there's any problem with the administration of our elections in Oregon.
Now, just to be clear, so, you know, with all the people talking about the possibility of elections being influenced by politics, why is that an important distinction? I mean, you said it's not that much of a distinction, but apparently some states have decided that it is.
Well, Oregon elections are generally very clean, and there hasn't been any particular scandal in other states. I'm thinking particularly of the East Coast. The partisan processes seem to impinge on everything. So separating the process with a board of elections might help insulate it from politics.
There's been a lot of talk about so-called down-ballot races and whether or not they're more subject to tampering than other races. First, can you explain what a down-ballot race is? And then can you elaborate a little bit about if they're subject to fraud any more than any other race?
Well, down ballot is literally down towards the bottom of the ballot. And these are typically city or county races where fewer voters are voting. And so it doesn't take as many votes anyway to alter the outcome. And so they might be more susceptible to fraud. However, any kind of fraud is very unlikely, especially in Oregon.
As part of those collection of comments, here's one from the Secretary of State's representative in Michigan.
Yeah, and this is Fred Woodham, WOODHAMS spokesman for Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. We have the checks and balances here in Michigan to make sure our elections are run with integrity. Since she took office, Secretary of State staff have doubled down on scrubbing the voter list of nearly 900,000 people who are deceased or who moved out of the state, and that eliminates vulnerabilities to our elections process. Michigan voters can have full confidence in the results this November.
I wanted to get your impressions of some of the comments that I received. As I said, I contacted all 50 secretaries of state, and hopefully more will be able to respond as we get closer to the election. But so far, about maybe 15 states have responded. And I wanted to get your thoughts over some of the comments that I got. If you don't mind, I'd like to go through some of those comments.
Go ahead.
Talk to me a little bit about the way the Secretary of State of Florida responded.
They were maintaining that Florida is takes issues election fraud very seriously, and they're confident in that all the votes will be counted.
Are those common themes that you would expect a Secretary of State or a Board of Elections to focus on, especially with all the talk of accusations around maybe improprieties in voter election systems?
Yeah, they would probably try to put the best face on anything that was publicly said, even though there might actually be some problems. You know, I don't know of any particular problem about the Florida system, but, you know, these are public officials, and they're not willing to admit probably anything might be wrong with their systems.
Right.
The fact is, computer systems are, you know, pretty well analogous to physical security, like for your home. And, you know, no matter how many locks that you put on the doors and windows of your home, if a thief has sufficient time to break in, they will, in fact, break in. The same thing with computers.
Right. Why is introducing doubt in our voting system, like Donald Trump is doing, a dangerous thing? I mean, our political system has been through worse, hasn't it?
Well, I think it has been through worse in the whole 150 years or so of our country's history. There's been lots of things go wrong with our election system. However, when the secret ballot was introduced in the early 1900s, the so-called Australian ballot, fraud was much less likely to happen. And again, it would take a lot more votes to affect the outcome of an election than just a handful of ballots that might be changed in the course of some sort of fraud.
One of the things that I've heard people talk about when they talk about the danger of calling our voting system into question is that it makes people begin to not believe in the system. And if the vote is the bedrock of our country, then some of those arguments are that you can contribute, that kind of doubt can contribute to the fracturing of the social contract that we have with each other and with the political system. Does that sound right?
Right. And, you know, challenging the vote is really challenging our democracy. And I would refer to the old adage that democracy is the worst government system of all, except all others. And if we somehow tear our democracy down, then we're going to get one of the other forms of government that are more less savory. So we might get a dictatorship or some sort of authoritarian government that we would like less. So we need to work hard at preserving our democracy, our freedoms, and our liberties.
It's really kind of hard to even conceive of the United States under a dictatorship or an authoritarian government.
I agree. It would be unthinkable.
We're also looking at statements by the Director of Elections in New Jersey, Director Rodriguez.
Yeah.
And his main comments seem to be monitoring the system for signs of suspicious activity, you know, conducting periodic vulnerability assessments. I mean, again, the issue seems to be focusing on cyber awareness and cybersecurity. Do you think that that is as big of a concern as it was maybe in the 2012 election when there were all these questions about Diebold election machines?
Well, I think they are saying appropriate things, but again, there's no such thing as perfect security. Probably the best security for a computer system is to have it physically isolated and not connected to the internet at all, or have a huge security barrier between the internet and the computer systems, if at all possible.
Here in Oregon, Jean Atkins, who is the Secretary of State here, she talked about the sheer number of votes and the decentralized nature of our election system.
Right.
She essentially said that the manipulation of the election's results here in Oregon is virtually impossible. But I also noticed that a lot of the Secretary of States are working with the Department of Homeland Security as a way to develop what she called a hygiene screen to take appropriate precautions.
They did that for Oregon, apparently.
Do you find that a lot of the election systems around the country are, in fact, working with the Department of Homeland Security to try to bring another level of legitimacy to the election results?
Well, I don't know that. I'm not involved in that process. You'd have to ask the Department of Homeland Security. But Jean Atkins is correct that the elections are decentralized in Oregon. Each county is responsible for its own elections, and they have some diversity in the way they go about that. And there's both diversity of process and the actual machinery that they use. Voting in Oregon is all by mail-in ballot, with some minor exceptions. So it's quite a bit different from other states that have polling place voting. Vote counting is actually done at each county's election department in a central place. It's not counted in precincts like it is in other states. And so it's less vulnerable to manipulation. You'd have to have an insider actually somehow affecting the counting process rather than poll workers like in other states might affect the counting.
I wanted to ask you about that. There was a big move, at least it was a big publicized move, of a lot of election machines from the manual machines to the electronic machines. Do you feel that that push toward more electronic machines has slowed in the last few years?
Yes, I think many jurisdictions bought new machinery back after the 2000 election and the Help America Vote Act, you know, after the fiasco in Florida, that many jurisdictions then had the money to buy new voting machines, and many of them bought electronic voting machines that didn't have any trace on how the vote actually occurred. And since that time, they've realized that it's better to have some sort of a paper log or trace that can be recounted or audited after the election. And that's the best practices rather than the wholly electronic voting machines.
Here's one from the Lieutenant Governor of Utah, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox.
So this is Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox from the great state of Utah. And when it comes to the integrity of our election system, it's something that we take very seriously here in the state of Utah. And I've assured voters here on many occasions that we have security systems in place, that there are no grand conspiracies when it comes to voter fraud. We encourage people to report any type of voter fraud that goes on. But I do believe that it is irresponsible and dangerous to allege large-scale voter fraud or a rigged system. And we know that that's not the case. It's very decentralized. Here in the state of Utah, we have 29 counties. They all conduct their own elections, and we have safeguards in place and checks and balances to make sure that those elections go off without a hitch and feel very confident that our elections are secure this year as always.
There have always been contrarians who, because of conspiracy theories or bad experiences with the government or just a general philosophical differences with our government system, they might not trust the election process. Is the rhetoric different in your opinion, and if so, how?
Well, the rhetoric this election is unprecedented. No national candidate has ever impugned the integrity of our election processes, and I think it's just preparing for the inevitable loss of, but it, the effect is to delegitimize the whole process. It maybe comes out of ignorance of the fact that you can't really manipulate 9,000 voting districts or even within a single state. You could conceivably affect a few votes by hacking into the computer systems and one state might be able to swing a race one way or another, but that wouldn't affect any other states. And so as long as the vote tallies are done well in all but maybe one state, then we're probably all right. The result for president anyway is based on electoral college votes, not on the individual votes in each state.
As one of another one of the comments that I received about the integrity of the voting process across the country, this is a representative of the Secretary of State of Virginia.
This is Edgardo Cortez. I'm the Commissioner of Elections in Virginia. Here in Virginia, we have 133 local registrars who administer the elections, as well as hundreds of other election officials, thousands of volunteers across our almost 2,500 polling places on election day. We also have volunteers from the parties and independent candidates that view and participate in many steps of the process. We certify our equipment. We check it prior to the election. And so we have a very good process here that's very open and transparent. And so this issue of calling into question the integrity of the system really does a disservice to our voters and also to all those professionals and volunteers that work diligently to guarantee a fair and open process. So we have absolute confidence that the results of this election are going to be an accurate reflection of the will of our voters, and that the public should have that same confidence when they go to cast their ballots on November 8th.
We've talked about some of the threats that the machines may face, but what about some of the other accusations, voter fraud and things to do with voters who aren't legitimately a part of the voting rolls, voting? I mean, from what I've read and from what I understand, the instances of those are very, very low. And I'm just wondering, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the kind of fraud that is targeted by voter ID, say, is very, very rare.